The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It's 1:45 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 28th, 2012, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Pascoe is here, Senator Coghill, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We have several matters to come before the committee today, beginning with board confirmations. And we have two people on the line and one person here in the room. Let's take those up first. We'll start with Brad Reich from Kiana, who wants to be on the Police Standards Council. Mr. Reich, are you there? Welcome to the committee. I understand you were just in Juneau yesterday. I'm sorry that we were not meeting so that we could have had you here in front of us. But go ahead and put yourself on the record. Tell us why you're interested in serving on this important council.
Well, we've been working really hard at trying to improve public safety within our region. And I'm on the Public Safety Commission for the borough. And I've got BPSO in my community along with BPO, and our whole intent is to try to promote public safety and show how it can help communities and also support it. And I'm the mayor of Kiana. I'm on the regional school board. I'm also on the Alaska Association of School Boards, and I'm also on our local liquor board here for the city of Kiana. So I just would like to try to help and see what we can do with the council to help get public safety within our region.
Sounds like a reasonable idea to me, Mr. Reich. Yeah, how long have you been the mayor?
This is my third term, and I took a 10-year break, and this is my second roundabout. I was a mayor back in 95, 96, 97.
Sounds like you have the support of your community, and you're also serving on the Public Safety Commission for the Northwest Arctic Borough. What does the Public Safety Commission do?
Well, basically, we're overseeing the BPSO program for our borough, setting plans of what we would like to see in the next 5 years with public safety within our region, and also looking at the COPS grant to work to get VPOs within the villages also.
Okay, and my last question is this. You'll be, if you are confirmed to the Police Standards Council, you'll be essentially sitting in judgment of police officers who have been accused of wrongdoing. Do you have any reason why you couldn't do that fairly, any bias or anything about your background that makes you sort of either very, very pro a police officer or very, very anti-officer or anything like that?
Well, I was VPSO back in 1991 for about a year and a half. So I got a little experience of being an officer, and to answer your question, no, I wouldn't have a problem.
Those are my questions. Any further questions from the committee? I don't see any. Mr. Reich, again, thank you for making yourself available. We'll wait till the very end when we'll take a motion to move you on to the full body, but I appreciate your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Jamie Sutherland, who should be on the line. Mr. Sutherland, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
And if you go ahead and put yourself on the record, tell us your name and affiliation, if any, and then go ahead and tell us about your interest in serving on the Police Standards Council.
Okay, no problem. Members of the committee, I am Jamie Sutherland. I currently serve as the Director of Public Safety, Chief of Police in Unalaska. I've been in this department for about 16 and a half years, the past four and a half as the chief. All those years are in Unalaska. Before that, I spent about a decade in the military. As far as education, I have a Master's of Business Administration degree. I am completely interested in the business of the APSC. I've attended a handful of their meetings in the past, and do like the idea of us holding our officers accountable for their actions, and certainly for misdeeds, there ought to be some repercussions for that. I think that the body does a good job of that, and I can be a valuable asset to that. I think that I've certainly been involved in discipline matters in the past, and am not afraid to deal with those issues.
Chief Sutherland, I appreciate your willingness to step forward. I just will point out to members of the public who may be listening that you spent 10 years in the United States Army Military Intelligence. You're also a graduate of the FBI National Academy, and apparently you speak some Russian as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I did for a decade there. And but that particular skill was not in high demand come around the mid-90s or early 90s.
Well, that's it's still it's good for your mental development, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I do serve on another state commission, and that's the State Emergency Response Commission, which meets a couple times a year as well.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I saw that you were interested in serving on that commission as well, and didn't know that you'd been appointed there. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Those are questions I have for Chief Sutherland. Further questions from the committee? I don't see any. I think we're all impressed by your resume, sir. And again, thank you for stepping forward. We'll wait and take a motion on all three candidates here at the conclusion of the next one. And that's Mr. Kreitzer. If you can come forward, we actually have him here in person. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Come on and take a seat. Put yourself on the record and tell us why you're interested in serving on the Alaska Judicial Council.
I'm Ken Kreitzer, and I live here in Juneau. When I retired from public safety after 25 years, I was looking for something very engaging and something very important, and I did serve on CACFA, Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, for 3 years, and afterwards I was looking for something else, and when this came up, I immediately recognized the importance of it, and then I went to the webpage and started realizing the immense importance of the council, and I thought, well, that would really be wonderful to be a part of something that's so important to the people of Alaska.
I think that's a fair opening statement, and I will agree. The Judicial Council is probably one of the more important councils that we make appointments to. You have a huge amount of influence on who becomes Alaska's judges. It's rare for us to turn a judge away once that judge is appointed by the governor, and you, of course, will be winnowing the field down for presentment of those individuals to the governor. Have you attended any Judicial Council meetings?
Yes, I was appointed in August 1st, and so far it's at least four meetings and six seats, three district court and three superior court.
So you've had the opportunity to go through the process several times now?
Yes, long process, a lot of work intensive, and but very engaging, very interesting, and I have enjoyed it.
Anything about the process that's caused you, I guess maybe my question is, what are the most difficult issues you think that you face as a Judicial Council member?
Well, we've had excellent people that have applied, and so the hardest part is getting the best of the best, and so you really do vet every applicant, and you really are looking for character and integrity and fairness and temperament, and so to pick the best of the best, it's not the easiest thing to do.
I think I agree. And is the Judicial Council in the process of picking a new Supreme Court justice, or where is that in the process? I know
that'll be happening in June.
So far your names, you haven't gotten the list of names out of the bar poll.
I think there's a list of 12 names.
Okay, that's out for a bar poll, and then they'll come to you for your interviewing.
Yes.
I see. Questions for Mr. Kreitzer. Senator Wilkowski.
Do you believe that the way we appoint judges is appropriate?
Yes, I think there's a real beauty to the system, that the council is strictly merit selection, and then the governor, he can, from those nominated applicants, he can pick from those any way that he'd like to. And that's actually, somewhat quoting the Chief Justice, because he thinks that it was beautiful, the system. And the system, I think we were only two when we started this system, and now there's 33 states that have similar systems. And so I think the system's great.
So, Wilkowski.
Thank you. There are some who've expressed concern about the way we select judges, some who think the governor should have the free rein to pick whoever he wants. There are some who want to change the process. And do you have an opinion one way or another about how we select judges in that regard?
I like the system the way that it is, but I'm open to suggestions. And I think most council members want to hear other people's opinions, but actually implementing them would, I'm not sure it's needed.
Do you have any plans to advocate for changes to the way we select judges, or have you ever advocated for changes to the way we select judges?
No, I've not.
Any plans to do so?
No, I really like the system. It's so engaging, and the way that that we vet people and the information that we get about people, I think sometimes when people think that we should just go on if they qualify or not is a little short-sighted, because we are looking for competence and also character. And you don't get those just when you ask that the council only wants us to look at if they're qualified.
Senator Wilkowski.
Unless other people have questions.
I've got, when you're finished, I've got a point to make, but that's fine.
Some people have expressed concern about so-called activist judges. And I'm just curious if you have an opinion about whether you would reject someone who you deem to be an activist judge, or how you would define an activist judge.
Well, if somebody went outside of the rule of law, I would consider that to be an activist judge. And if it was against the legislature and what's been signed into law, if it was outside of common sense, or if they're trying to push their personal beliefs and they have trouble being impartial, well, I would consider that to be an activist, and they probably wouldn't get my vote. And I can't imagine getting anybody else's vote on the council.
Can you think of any examples of judicial activism that which would cause you to reject someone for being a judge? Any specific examples, actual cases, for example?
Well, I haven't really thought about it, but if it...
I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but
yeah,
just
I haven't
trying
really
to.
Thought about it.
I'll give you a minute to ponder that. Let me just while you're pondering that, I think it's a fair question, but you can think about it for a minute. The public should know just a little bit more about Mr. Kreitzer. Has a Bachelor of Arts from Wright State University. Has what I would call an Alaskan resume of being a city councilman, a deckhand in Southeast Fisheries, correctional officer, airport safety officer, drilling fluids engineer, professional firefighter, legislative aide, city treasurer, and EMT technician. As well as having been a PSEA board member in the corrections chapter. So, a nice breadth of experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what I would call an Alaskan resume. So now that I've given you a minute to think, any response to Senator Wilkowski's question? Or
if somebody was trying to push their agenda, whatever it would be, whether it be abortion or keep their own personal opinions out of it. You're really looking for somebody that's true to the rule of law.
And some have said that the decision in Roe versus Wade was the product of activist judges. And would you agree that that was an activist decision, or disagree with that?
You know, you are putting me on the spot, because I have not really thought about that.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I know.
Senator Coghill.
I know that's a hot-button issue, but even here in this committee, we've talked about activists, whether it's the Citizens United or whatever.
Sure.
And so, I know that this one kind of strikes at the heart of a lot of issues, but I think all of us at one point or another disagree with the judge's position. I don't know that having this particular issue brought up, I just wonder how salient it is if somebody's willing to be impartial.
Well, and I'm not trying to make this a question of where your politics are, because the governor, you know, your politics are not relevant. What we're asking, what I'm simply trying to get at is, I'm trying to understand your position on activist judges, and if you believe what you think are activist judges. You said you would disqualify people who are activist judges, and so I'm trying to understand. Some people have said Citizens United was an activist judge, was a decision issued by, was judicial activism, which was outside the bounds of what they should decide. Some people say Roe versus Wade is judicial activism outside the bounds. So I'm just trying to get your position. If you had a judge before you, I mean, do you consider those decisions to be decisions of judicial activists? I think that's a fair question, Mr. Chairman. But I'm out of line.
I'm saying that it's not a fair question, but sitting on the council and the way that we select and interview applicants, unless they've been vocal and editorialized their point of view, we don't really go into somebody's point of view or their belief system. We're just looking at merit. Your question would be something that you might want to ask the governor. Sees activists, where my role on the council is all about merit and character and those kind of things. And so I wouldn't even know, for the most part, unless they've been very vocal about their points of view, I wouldn't know if they were going to be an activist. There might be something in somebody's comments, and then we would have that person talk about it. And we really are looking for the loyalty to the rule of law. And I think that would come out. And if there was something that was in one area, whatever it is, that came out in that person's interview, well, then it's the council. We talk about it. And sometimes we come to consensus about a person and whether or not, they would be loyal to the rule of law. So I probably give myself more time, because my opinion about that doesn't even enter into my role in the council. It's kind of inappropriate to even go there with applicants and with other council members.
Let me ask you maybe a slightly different question. Had there been names forwarded on to the governor in the meetings you've sat on that you disagreed with, names you think should not have gone on to the governor?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, some people I thought were more qualified or had a better breadth of experience, or were more mature, or I just felt more comfortable if I was sitting in front of a judge, for something. And so it was, but I've been happy with every person that the council has nominated. They might not have been my favorites, but at the same time, they were definitely qualified and they were competent. And whoever the governor chose, I was happy with.
And let me just turn around one more. That's my last question, which is, were there applicants who you felt should have gone on to the governor but couldn't get out of the council?
Yeah, one or two.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
And were you the lone sort of believer in that, or was there like a minority view?
No, I've never been the lone belief on any
okay.
Person.
Okay.
But if I was, that's just the way it is, just one vote.
Just the way it works. Those are my questions. Further questions? That I'd solicit a motion for all three. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we forward the names of Brad Reich, Jamie Sunderland, and Kenneth Kreutzer onto the full body for a vote at a joint session.
Mr. Kreutzer, thanks for being here. Thanks so much. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, your name will be forwarded onto the full body for confirmation in just about 2 weeks, I think.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. With that, let's turn to the bills we have. And we have, first of all, HB6. And we should have a representative of the sponsor's office coming forward, Mr. Madsen. And a new version of HB6, which I believe is /G like golf. I just lost my vice chair, so if I can get a motion to accept geez. People are coming and going. Senator.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we bring the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 6 version /G before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. Mr. Madsen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ted Madsen, staff for Representative Max Gruenberg. I'm just going to quickly walk through the changes between the O.A version that passed from the House and the Y version of House Bill 6 that you have before you.
Okay.
At the suggestion of the Board of Regents in their March 9th, 2012 letter, several changes have been incorporated into House Bill 6. The first is on page 1, line 14, through page 2, line 4 of the Y version. It is subsection A, paragraph 3, and it has been changed to state that it is not clear whether the Board of Regents has the constitutional authority to suspend or remove a regent. There was also one grammatical change to the that section 1. There are also a couple of minor grammatical changes that I will not be discussing throughout section 2. If you would like me to, I can go through those. The next substantive change is section 2A, paragraph 4, which is on page 2, line 23, through page 3, line 3 of the Y version. It has been changed to make the suspension procedure more rigorous in the case of malfeasance or nonfeasance in office. There are three things that are now required. A sworn complaint, then the governor must investigate the allegations, and finally find probable cause to proceed further and suspend the regent. It's important to note that there is additional language in this subsection that will prohibit proceedings based upon political differences or the discretionary performance of a lawful act or a prescribed duty. This was done to ensure that such things as a student who is upset with a tuition increase would not be able to lodge a complaint and have a regent suspended because of that. And this was done at the suggestion of the Board of Regents.
Was this in, Mr. Madsen, was this in response to there? I think it was a March 9 letter?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yeah, I read that letter, and I thought they made good points.
Yes, indeed, as did the sponsor of this bill, and so we have worked together with the legislative liaison from the Board of Regents closely to try and accommodate their concerns.
Very good.
The next change is to subsection A, paragraph 5, was changed to require a formal allegation or charge by a licensing board to proceed to a suspension proceeding. This was done to sort of enhance the procedure and make it a little bit more rigorous. Subsection D, which is on page 3, lines 15 through 22 of the Y version, was changed to require that if a hearing is to be held, the Office of Administrative Hearings will conduct it. This is sort of in another way to insulate the Board of Regents from political directions from the governor. Required that a administrative law judge conduct a hearing. The hearing officer will also be required to issue a decision. Subsection G, paragraph 5, this sort of mirrors the language which is on page 4, lines 14 through 17. This mirrors the new language in A4, in A5, and this was changed to clarify that a violation of a professional or occupational licensing statute that results in the revocation or suspension of a professional or occupational license that is related to the regent's ability to serve will be grounds for suspension or removal for a regent. Section 3 was added to include the proceedings, the removal and suspension proceedings of a regent in the list of the proceedings that the Office of Administrative Hearings has to conduct. And that is page 4, line 20, through page 6, line 15.
So just so I am clear about the process, if a regent commits some wrongdoing, a complaint is filed, the governor finds there's probable cause, actual trial takes place in front of an administrative law judge?
It takes place in front of the Office of Administrative Hearings, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Very good. Those are my questions. Other questions? Senator Coghill.
A couple questions. On page 4, line 5, a violation of a licensing, my guess is that this is on lines 14 through 16, 17, on page 4. If a violation of a licensing reg, is there degrees? For example, a late fee versus blatant violation of licensing practice. I mean, is that something they figure into it, or is this a hard line that says you violate, you go across the line, and there's no discretion?
Senator Coghill through the chair, it would have to be related to a regent's fitness to serve as a regent. So, for example, I do not believe that being late with a fee would necessarily rise to that occasion.
Okay. That's a good point. Point well taken. So, I guess my view, I was wondering if it created the fitness issue or if it was a, or if it, the fitness issue was different than the licensing violation. And I was just trying to figure out. So it, the fitnessing to serve as a regent, if the barrier is a violation, I want to know how serious that violation has to be.
Senator Coghill through the chair, I believe that it would have to be related to such things as, for example, the Bar Association, a crime of dishonesty, breach of trust, and that sort of thing would remove, would potentially suspend or revoke a person's bar license. And so I believe that that's the sort of thing that would be related to a regent's ability to serve, crimes of dishonesty, breach of trust, that sort of thing that are before a licensing body. Okay.
And that was my expectation, but I wanted to make sure of that. And then the other thing, Mr. Chairman, if I might, at the very last of the bill, it's on or before, and I need that explained to me again, the applicability of this applies to all conduct before, on, or after the effective date. So how far does that reach back? At least explain what the expectation of that is to me.
Mr. Madsen?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Coghill. The applicability section is to ensure that if there is currently some sort of ill-doing right now going on, that it happened, say, 6 months ago, a year ago, and it's currently being investigated by a law enforcement agency, and it comes out after this bill is passed, but occurred before the initial, the effective date of this act, it's still able, this act will still apply to that.
I guess the question for me is, have there been regents that have been dismissed to date?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, there have not been any regents who have been dismissed to date. There was the instance with Mr. Hayes a few years back who that the legislature had to deal with and or was beginning to have impeachment proceedings brought against him.
And then he stepped down.
Right. And I just, you know, anytime you put on or before, I always think, how do you reach back and are we putting a fishing expedition in? I just, you know, I'm just thinking out loud.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair question. I mean, we always want to be cautious when we say that a penalty can be administered for acts that were committed before we sort of laid out what the penalty phase looks like.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a good question. Further questions? Mr. Madsen, thank you. This is a CS that's makes some minor changes to a bill we've now heard twice. Further community discussion about the bill. So what's the motion?
Senator Coghill. Before we do, you know, it does trouble me some, the honor before. Is there a better way of saying that, that anything under consideration, you know, I just struggle with that. And maybe it's just I don't have a full comprehension of how that would reach back under our practical application of law, but it is something I struggle with. And is there a better way of saying that?
Well, let me. This is the last committee referral for the bill, correct? We've got two plus weeks left. Why don't we just hold the bill over till Friday and kick it around? You can talk to the Department of Law
if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. I would love this. Anytime we reach back, if there's a better way of saying it, I'd be interested, and I'll have my staff, I'll task them to help me find it.
Talk to Ledge Legal, talk to the Department of Law, make sure you're comfortable with it.
You don't mind.
You've been a very loyal member of the committee, and I totally appreciate your, you've made quorum for us several times, Senator, and so I'm loathe to jam this bill through when it is the last committee, and there's plenty of time left in the session. So with that, we'll set the bill aside for the time being and expect to take it back up on Friday and turn now to SB 168. Which is the backslash we have before us is the backslash M. It's a bill we heard earlier this week and just kind of held it over for the same reason, just to make sure everybody was comfortable with what we were doing. There have been no changes to the bill. I don't think there's any, you know, unless any member needs further questions answered, this bill goes on to the Finance Committee. And so I'd solicit the motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 168-M out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, this bill is moved. We'll take a short ad, ease to the paperwork. Back on the record, and for those who may be listening or watching, SB 198 is going to be set aside for the time being while further work is done on that bill. And that brings up the last matter before the committee today, and that's Senate CS for House Bill number 215, which we got a brief hearing on some time ago, but we've got a nice full house full of folks who are here to educate us about it, including Representative Hawker, which we take great delight in welcoming the representative to the committee. Oh, and my goodness, and the Speaker of the House. I'm putting on my glasses now because I want to see who else is out there. I'm thrilled to welcome you both here. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for making time for us, and please give us any introductory remarks you'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for having, just for the record, Representative Chenault, District 34, Kenai Peninsula. Mr. Chairman, I think we heard the bill earlier. If you'd like us to refresh your memories on what transpired, I can certainly have my staff. He's more knowledgeable on the technical aspects of this bill.
But, that's probably a good idea, just to give us maybe just a 2 minutes to bring us up to speed, because I think it was a fairly compressed hearing of about 20 minutes in duration, and we were just trying to get into the details. But it would be helpful to have Mr. Wright bring us up to speed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff to the Speaker. And the objective of House Bill 215, as noted in the sponsor statement, is to prohibit the filing of lawsuits that have the potential to delay construction of in-state gas lines. The provisions modify current statute, and they only apply to state land rights-of-way. Claims may be filed only by an applicant, a competing applicant, or a person who has a direct financial interest affected by the lease of a right-of-way. Requests for judicial review must be filed within 60 days of the publication notice for a right-of-way lease application and may only be granted for claims challenging the validity of the statute or challenging a denial of rights under the state constitution. Any claim will be barred unless it's filed within the 60-day time frame, and that means from the effective date of this bill, since most of the right-of-way leases on state land have been granted or are in the process of being granted. The Department of Environmental Conservation, due to EPA standards, are cut out from the bill just so we don't violate EPA and have the EPA coming in and providing jurisdiction over, you know, any clean water, clean air, privacy that the DEC can provide. All claims are to be filed in the Superior Court. They'll have exclusive jurisdiction to determine the proceeding. Court cannot issue any injunctive release except for a final judgment. And this is judicial review was in the TAPS legislation that was passed by Congress, also part of ANCTA way back when in the late 70s. And also there's a judicial review portion in a GS. So this is not something new.
Thanks for that. Thanks for the good overview. Questions for the bill sponsor or his aide? We also have available to us Ken Vassar from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corp. We have Ann Brown from the Department of Natural Resources, Daryl Kleppen, and Tina Grovier. I know Ms. Grovier is an attorney, and I'm not sure what Mr. Kleppen's area of expertise is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I should remark, too, I forgot another important provision that's included within the bill, if I may. It also allows AGDC to move from a common carrier to a contract carrier, you know, through the right-of-way leasing statutes. And this is necessary, of course, to pursue a successful open season and also project financing for an in-state gas line. As a common carrier, it'd be pretty hard to go to the bond markets, and Mr. Pawlski can explain this a lot better than I, with a common carrier contract rather than a common carrier line rather than a contract line. So the contract line is in place in order for them to pursue financing of the project.
Sure. Thank you. And thanks for reminding me that Mr. Duba is here as well as Mr. Pawlski. So we really do have a lot of horsepower here to help us understand this bill. I guess my first question is, and we and the members should have a memo that Ledge Legal did for us actually about a year ago, October 15, 2011, from Don Bullock, talking about some of the constitutional issues that the bill presents. But I guess the phrase that is uppermost in my mind right now is direct financial interest. And can you shed any light on who that might be and how direct is a direct financial interest? Or maybe we should turn to one of the attorneys on the line. It's up to you.
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer to turn it over to one of the attorneys. And I believe John Hutchins is also here from the Department of Law, who
okay.
might be able to answer that.
Who wants to lead off on this this first of many legal questions? If someone doesn't raise their hand, I'm going to call on you. I always wanted to say that. I used to hate it when teachers said that.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this is Ken Vassar in Anchorage. I'm here with Tina Grovier, and we've each had a hand in helping to prepare this language. Person who would have a direct financial interest affected by the lease of the right-of-way would primarily be a person who was a competing applicant, I think.
And maybe just give me, who is going to be the applicant here? Isn't AGDC the applicant?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, AGDC is the applicant. Well, The right-of-way has already been leased to AHFC, and part of this legislative effort will involve moving that over to AGDC, which is the appropriate agency to have the lease, as opposed to AHFC.
Right, and I guess how much of the right-of-way does AHFC have under lease right now?
AHFC has all of the right-of-way under lease right now.
Okay, and when you say all the right-of-way, do you mean a continuous right-of-way from the North Slope to Anchorage?
Mr. Chairman, this is actually, I believe, the state-owned portion of the right-of-way that DNR had authority to lease out. There are other owners of parts of the route, and those parts are not part of this lease.
Okay, and does someone have, maybe probably the easiest way is not to do it so much in language as in a map. Does someone have a map that sort of shows which parts are currently, how much of the right-of-way is currently held by HFC and how much is not? Because that's just been something that's been sort of percolating in the back of my mind as we've considered this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Mr. Wright.
Now, I don't know if we have a map or not, but it's over 300 miles of right-of-way is the information I just received. They have applied, and Joe can answer this better than I, but the application has been submitted to the federal government for federal right-of-ways as well.
Okay. So that brings up an interesting wrinkle. That is, of this 600-mile pipeline, and I'll just use 600 as a term of art, or you know, turn of phrase. Some is fed, some is state. Of this, and can you break it out? How much is each of each? How many miles of federal right-of-way are involved?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler. I'm the Vice President, Chief Financial Officer of AGDC. There's 437 miles of state right-of-way, and the federal, I believe we have Dave Haugen online as well. He's our project manager. He might be able to tell us how much is the federal right-of-way. I don't know the exact number. I know that combined it's over 90% of the entire right-of-way would be ours when we attain the federal right-of-way.
I see. Mr. Haugen, are you there?
We are, Mr. Chairman, we are obtaining him for you.
Okay.
Give us a moment.
That's okay. Nothing but time.
He's here in the room now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and Mr. Haugen, did you hear?
He wasn't here.
Yeah, did you hear the question? The question is, how many in this proposed in-state gas pipeline? We understand about 437 miles of the proposed route is state right-of-way. How many miles of federal right-of-way?
It's over 200. I don't have the exact number,
okay.
Mr. Chair, and we can get that for you, and okay. Be happy to do so.
That's fine. And just so I'm clear, does this act have any impact whatsoever on the federal right of way? We're all clear that no. That's all got to be dealt with. Thank you for the on-the-record answer. So we're just dealing with the state right of way, and there are 437 miles of state right of way. Are there additional lands that this pipeline has to cross that are not state and not federal?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler, again, from AGDC. Yes, there are. There are, I believe, both native allotments and private lands and some, I think, mental health trust lands as well. There's quite a grab bag of private interests that we'll be negotiating with for rights of way for the remainder of the alignment.
And none of those rights of ways are currently held by either AHFC or AGDC?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. And where, just to ballparking, where are those lands concentrated? Are they interior Alaska, or are they around Anchorage, or is it just scattered?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the bulk of them are towards the Anchorage, Big Lake area. There are some up around Fairbanks as well, and I believe some around Cantwell. But the bulk of the state right-of-way is up north. The federal, there's some we go... I honestly don't know exactly where the federal rights of way are located, but we will get you a map that breaks them out. I know we have them back at the office. We'll get you a map.
The map would be handy. Sometimes it's just easier to understand. And just to be clear, this bill gives you the right to go out and negotiate those rights of ways and to try to collect them all into one corridor.
Mr. Chairman, no. This bill only applies to state rights of way. The state can't dictate what the federal government right-of-way or the private land as well. This is only for the state right-of-way.
Okay, very good. And for the private right-of-way, what happens if you have a recalcitrant landowner?
Mr. Chairman, as with most governmental projects, we do have we're asking for the right to eminent domain, that if we cannot reach an arm's-length negotiated price for the land, for the right-of-way with a private landowner, we would have the right of eminent domain to go ahead and condemn that property and take it for the purposes of the gas pipeline.
And then pay a fair market value.
Yes, of course, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, Tom Wright again, there is already in statute for gas pipelines the right to eminent domain. It's also included in the other legislation, but there's also statutory authority as of right now to invoke eminent domain.
I mean, it's always a scary-sounding phrase, but it's a phrase the government essentially has to have. If you're going to have roads, if you're going to have pipelines, if you're going to have power lines, at some level you can't let one landowner hold you up. As much as we love and cherish our Alaskan landowners, at some point you have to give way to the greater good. It's utilitarianism, I think. But that does sort of lead to the question of what's the route for this pipeline?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
The route. Which landowners might be, I mean, when we talk about, for example, the Kinnickarn Bridge, so people know where it's going to start and stop, and they sort of know who's nervous. Government Hill's nervous because they're worried about their land. Who should be nervous about this pipeline?
Mr. Chairman, hopefully nobody will be nervous about the pipeline. Hopefully everybody's as excited about the pipeline as most of the beneficiaries of it, but the folks that might, I would assume the folks around Big Lake down through through the Willow area, I mean, that's where the pipeline is going to be going. We have on staff a contractor that's very experienced from Department of Transportation, has used her extensively over the years to obtain private property from in programs like this. And she's begun identifying the private landowners and has begun negotiating or will begin negotiating soon for the obtaining the rights of way for the private land for this pipeline.
Excellent. And you didn't mention my community of Anchorage. Is it the case that once you tee into the distribution network in Big Lake that you have sufficient capacity to move up to 500 million MCF of gas through there without further pipelines, without the further construction of more pipelines?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. We're going to enter the what's called the NSTAR pipeline system at Beluga across the inlet from Anchorage, and this pipeline never actually enters the municipality of Anchorage.
Okay. It's not exactly the ACO hub, but I guess it's the best we can do.
It is.
Okay. All right. And back to my original question, direct financial interest. Ms. Grovier, do you have any, or do you or any of the legal staff available to us have some light you can shed on who that would be?
Mr. Chairman, the language that we're speaking of is in existing statute, and that's where it came from. I believe it's a test that was raised in certain circumstances where people are perhaps commenting on a proceeding but not an actual party. I think one of the things they look for is whether that particular individual who is a non-applicant, they would want it to rise to that certain level in order to have standing. So I'm trying to think of an example, but if it weren't the applicant, perhaps a landowner who had a, you know, the financial interest in adjacent land, for example, perhaps.
Okay, so let's just flesh this out. Do you think the people who would have direct financial interest would be a competing applicant, that is, someone besides AGDC who would say, "Gee, I want to build this in-state gas pipeline," and they would bring a challenge? Or could bring a challenge?
That's one possibility.
Okay.
Yes.
A competitor, whoever that might be, although it seems like we're sort of structuring this. I mean, we can talk about that more later. A competitor, a landowner whose land the pipeline crosses, right?
Certainly.
And
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, you're about to say... you're about to qualify that landowner.
Well, I think it would have to be, because this is dealing with a state right-of-way, it would have to be an adjacent, I would imagine, landowner.
So a landowner who whose property sort of came close to where the right-of-way is but doesn't cross it, who says, gee, this pipeline's going to affect my land values.
Yes.
Okay. And, let's go to the other extreme. A consumer, an Anchorage consumer who just thinks this is not a good idea is not going to be able to challenge this.
I think, let me take one step back, which
sure.
is the framework that you see reflected in the bill is the same framework that exists under statute today. There was no change to that other than, I think, a slight reordering. Is that helpful at all?
Sure. I mean, I remember this debate from AGIA, is where I remember most clearly from, and we went to a lot of sort of trouble to make sure that any challenges that were going to be brought soon, so we didn't get halfway through the project and then suddenly get derailed by a lawsuit. We walked through it very, very carefully and made sure we knew, you know, sort of who was in, who was out, and how quickly they were going to have to bring their challenges. And did we also adopt a 60-day timeline in AGIA, or was it 90?
I can't speak to AGIA, but I do know that the existing section 3835-200 has a 60-day timeline in it.
Right. I've got that in front of me, and I'm looking at the 60 days after the effective date of the act and so forth.
You're in subsection C.
5. I'm looking at subsection 5, page 6.
Subsection C.
Yep.
All right. This section is all new language.
All new, exactly. Right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, it's Ken Vassar.
Hi, Ken.
Hi. If it helps, and maybe I'm repeating what Tina just said, but the language in the statute, the way that I read this, is it's setting a standard that somebody would have to demonstrate in order to have the ability to exercise the right that this subsection would grant. So it would be incumbent upon the person who claims this right, that is the right to object to the lease, to demonstrate that they have a direct financial interest. With the language being in the statute as it is, we don't necessarily have the background on whether somebody was intended to be included in that, and it may be difficult to identify who, if it came down to a court challenge, would be able to carry that burden of demonstrating that they have a direct financial interest. One idea, and I don't say this in any definitive way, but one idea along the lines and consistent with the competing applicant phrase is that it might be another person who wants to lease the same land, but wouldn't be a competing applicant in the sense that they don't have the same project or the same type of project. You know, maybe they want to lease the land to use it for a different purpose, but by virtue of this project leasing the land, it makes it either more difficult or more expensive, or in some way gets in the way of their ability to lease that land. Then that person might go to a court and say, you know, I have a direct financial interest in this, and I'd really like to have a say on whether these guys get to lease this land.
I appreciate that clarification. That was very helpful. And let me ask, and maybe that I was mixing up apples and oranges, the 60-day time frame that I was just referencing on page 6, lines 23 and so forth, that's a challenge to the constitutionality of this provision, correct? I'm getting head nods.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, that's Tom Wright. I think I just heard Tina Grovier say the same thing.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And
that's correct.
That's
and that it's in part to that, but that 60 days, if you're talking about that came from the TAPA legislation.
Okay.
That's where that idea came from, as opposed to subsection A of the bill of this statute, where you're talking about the direct financial interest language came from, if that's helpful.
Right, that's a separate challenge. It's also that's
correct.
Existing law. Just for people who are listening and watching, it's in law right now. It was put in law in 1973 that an applicant or competing applicant or a person who has a direct financial interest affected by the lease, that's the lease of the state right away, who raises objections within 60 days of the publication of notice, are the only persons withstanding to seek judicial review of the decision. That's been law for over 30, almost 40 years. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is probably a question for either our lawyers or some lawyers on the phone, but my understanding was that when it came to the constitutionality of a provision, that could be raised any time. In other words, if you're violating the Constitution, you can't limit the ability to challenge that by statute. Is that am I incorrect in that?
I will turn to one of the lawyers, but I'm pretty sure we did it in AGEA. So if we were wrong then, we're about to be wrong again. But Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chairman, I can give you the judicial review in AGEA. In states, a person may not bring a judicial action challenging the constitutionality of this chapter or the constitutionality of a license issued under this chapter unless the action is commenced in a court of the state of competent jurisdiction within 90 days after the date that the license is issued.
I remember spending many, many hours on that, and thank you for bringing that memory back.
And is there an attorney on the line that we could – is there a case? I'd just be curious if there's a case on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, we did research that with John Hutchins from the Department of Law as far as TAPS was concerned, and he was not able to find any challenges that were brought up you know, during that period or afterwards.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coghill.
You guys are probably way deeper into this than I am, but it looks to me like, first, it's the validity of the section, and there's a, and that would deal with the rights under the Constitution. But is that is what is referred to on line 25 as that action?
Sorry, I took my eye off the ball for a second.
I mean, section 5, lines 23, the first is brought at 60 days after the effective date of the act. That's claiming the constitutionality. And then another to, must be brought within 60 days following the date of that action. So help me understand those two dynamics there.
Let's turn to Mr. Dubler.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler with AGDC. The action I believe they're referring to there is the signing of the lease with the state.
Okay.
All these things refer to just the state lease of the right-of-way between AGDC and DNR. And obviously, I guess the first part about the effective date of the act, I'm assuming, would be July 1, so it would be 60 days after that.
Okay.
And since the lease has already been signed, that it would be the later of, so probably 6 days after July 1.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hutchins has, you know, can expound on the answer that I just gave about challenges.
Great. Mr. Hutchins, welcome to the committee.
John Hutchins of the Department of Law. To answer your question.
You got to get real close to the mic.
Sorry, John Hutchins of the Department of Law. Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. The 60-day language, as Mr. Wright said, comes from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act. I think the original model was probably the wartime Office of Price Administration, the price controls, and those were upheld in YACUS, the 60-day limit to challenge the constitutionality of the act or of an action by the OPA was exactly the same and was upheld by the Supreme Court there. I'm not aware of any Alaska case that looks at it. They may be out there. I just haven't found them yet.
So, I couldn't, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And thanks for refreshing my memory. So it was upheld by the U.S. Constitution?
It was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court under the U.S. Constitution, yes.
And what was the fact scenario in that case?
Oh.
That was the provision of the United States Constitution, and there was a federal law that said you had a time limit on ability to challenge.
Yes, there was a federal law, the price regulation statutes during the war, that limited the ability of someone affected by a ruling of the Office of Price Administration to challenge a determination on prices. Case could only be brought within 60 days of the action, and the U.S. Supreme Court reviewed it and upheld the challenge, upheld the provision of the statute.
And Mr. Hutchins, while we have you here, have you reviewed the memo prepared by Mr. Bullock in April of last year?
I recall looking at it in April of last year, so my memory is not going to be the best on it.
I reviewed it today. So, there is some discussion of this on page 5 of the memo, and I hope someone's bringing you a copy good. And towards the bottom of page 5, I think beginning in the third paragraph, it says the limitations on bringing a claim are set by law. And it starts talking about latches. And for people who are listening, latches is just a fancy legal word for meaning that means if you wait too long, sleeping on your rights. The case that Mr. Bullock discusses is a case in which there were oil and gas leases conducted, I think, in Kachemak Bay, and there was a provision in that lease that said you couldn't challenge it after a certain length of time. At the bottom of this description on page 5 of the Bullock memo, court sort of indicated that limitations are disfavored. And the court found the plaintiffs were not guilty of inexcusable delay and sufficient prejudice had not been established on the record. And I'll just put that out there, and maybe we can have a fuller discussion of that after you've got a chance to go back and think about it.
Well, I can give you my initial reaction,
sure.
Which is that they're discussed. Latches is obviously a common law doctrine, and I believe that Moore here is making a distinction between common law and statute, the statute of limitations. In this case, this is actually a statutory limitation on bringing an action, and the question is whether the legislature has the power to impose a time limit to bring an action. And again, I'm not sure Moore is on point here. The case most relevant is Yakis, and the cases subsequent to Yakis that have essentially affirmed Yakis's holding.
Okay. And did you give us a cite to Yakis? You can send it over to my office.
I haven't given you a cite.
It's not supposed to be a law school exam. I'm just just send a cite over when the meeting's over.
Sure, I'll do that.
Thank you so much.
I can just ask
Senator Paskin.
What type of constitutional challenges might there be? I mean, I understand on the pricing issue back in World War II and probably under some War Powers Act is what I'm just absolutely wild guessing about, but bringing it to 2012, what type of potential constitutional actions is it that we're trying to limit? In other words, I would think that as part of the record, a court would want to know that we addressed certain specific things, and how can we validate that we considered those things unless they're presented to us?
Through the chair to Senator Pascavan, I think the most obvious constitutional challenge would be an action by the commissioner deprives someone of a property interest some sort without due process, inadequate notice by the commissioner when it's making a decision on a lease or a permit that's subject to this section. The whole gamut of due process considerations, I think, would come into this, as well as more direct constitutional infringements, and I'm trying to think of something that's obvious right now, but the only thing I'm coming up with is a property.
So, in other words, and again, my limited understanding of the due process, but we have economic interests and non-economic interests, and in those non-economic interests, you have potentially protected classifications. I assume that the only thing we're talking about here is economic interests and due process, both substantive and procedural, addressing those economic interests. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair to Senator Pascavan, I don't want to be flippant, but if I'm understanding your question correctly, then yes, I would agree that it's difficult to see how, for example, constructing a gas pipeline would result in a civil rights violation. I think for the most part, we are dealing with things that could in some sense be measured by an economic loss.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
In other words, I just think that is what should be laid out on the record, precisely what those issues are, because, I think that it would be important to have considered those types of things in the area of economic due process, just so that we have considered them.
Mr. Dubler, and then Mr. Cockhill. Senator Cockhill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to further address Senator Pascavan's question, the lease has already been issued to AGDC by DNR, and we followed all the due process that was required in statute. So to raise that after the fact, I think, would be, if that were the only constitutional challenge, I think we've already addressed that through complying with the due process in applying for and obtaining that permit. So
what you're saying is HSC already has the right-of-way.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
This bill just pushes it over to AGDC.
Right. I'd like to add a little bit more just to continue to clarify the record, as Senator Pascavan has suggested. It's true that there is a right-of-way lease that exists today. This section would affect more than just the right-of-way decision. This affects permitting decisions that relate to the right-of-way, so it's possible that there could be a constitutional challenge relating to a permitting decision that has not yet been made, and this section would certainly affect that.
Senator Cockhill.
On page 6, under the new subsection line 28 and 29, the final judgment that is the exception here before the Superior Court may not grant injunctive relief. Help me understand the process on that. So the final, except a conjunction with the final judgment, what would a final judgment be under this section?
Through the chair to Senator Cockhill. So let's assume that an action has been brought and the party bringing the action prevail. I'll throw out a hypothetical. Let's say that someone had a land use permit to use part of the land that's in the right-of-way corridor. The right-of-way lease and the construction activities in the pipeline have impaired the ability of that person to exercise his rights under the land use permit he has. He believes that the commissioner did not adequately take into account his use of the land when issuing the right-of-way to AGDC and didn't notice him of the pipeline in such a way that he was able to comment. So he has brought a constitutional challenge. He would not be able to bring a challenge. He would not be able to get a temporary restraining order against construction of the pipeline. If there were a final judgment in his favor, if the court decided that, yeah, he was correct, that there was inadequate notice, then he could get an injunction from the court that would reverse whatever the court has done that affect whatever the commissioner has done that affected his interests.
Okay.
Senator Pastor.
If I understand that, and maybe, again, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're, I think, more skilled in this than I am, but as I understand what Senator Hoggill is interested in, if we are only dealing with economic interests and whatever that individual's maximum interest can be cured in money, you are not going to grant an injunction against the project if the total remedy is always in money.
Through the chair to Senator Pascuan, yes, it's true that in general, injunctive relief is disfavored where adequate damages remedies. That's one of the reasons that provisions like this that bar temporary injunctive relief have been upheld in the past. I can probably imagine circumstances under which a damages remedy might be held to be inadequate. For example, if there's a stream crossing involved that required some construction that couldn't be remediated simply with a dollar outlay, there might also be a bar to an injunction in that case as well.
Mr. Chairman,
it
seemed to me that the first issue is if there's a right violated, that he could get a judgment on that, but not get the stop the project, basically. But if there was a valuation issue, it could be based on the judgment as well, still no injunctive relief?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, yes, that is correct. The point of this is to prevent legal delay from delaying the project as well. Legal delay imposes all sorts of costs, and essentially this allocates the burden of costs associated with legal delay.
I just need you to hear it out loud, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions about, so we kind of jumped right into Section 5. We spent a fair amount of time, and it's Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. How set is the line route?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the line route as it currently exists, there are several alternatives that we've applied for in our federal EIS process that's currently in the draft EIS process. We expect the final EIS sometime this summer, and with that would be a record of decision, and with that comes the federal right-of-way. So that while there are some alternatives, there's a preferred route in there, and the preferred route was based upon the minimal impact to streams and wetlands and other environmentally sensitive areas, as well as minimizing the actual mileage of the pipeline to minimize the impact upon the environment. Those are all things that the federal government looks for in an environmental impact statement application. So the current alignment was based on that. Like I said, there are some alternatives that if they don't like our current alignment, they can come back and say, well, no. For instance, the park, the Denali Park, our current alignment skirts around the outside of the park. If for some reason they decide they don't like that, we have an alternative alignment that goes through the park. I can't imagine that the impact on the park would be less going through the park, but if that's what the federal BLM decides, then that's what they would do. As an aside, once the BLM is done, we will actually get a lease from the federal government for that land, and we've got a letter from the BLM, I believe we got it last week, stating that they're happy with the application and that once the process is complete, we will get that right-of-way lease.
So. Mr. Chairman, so as I understand, the 60-day requirement is 60 days after this bill becomes effective, which would be, if we passed it soon, it'd be sometime in July or August. 60 days from then, someone has to file a constitutional challenge without knowing where the route potentially is. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there are several alternatives, and knowing that the preferred route, I mean, if, assuming this passes and July 1 is the date, that would give him through the end of July, August 1st of September, so end of August, to file a complaint. But by then, we will have our final route, I believe, because the process will be complete, and we'll actually have the lease. Just for the record, this only applies to the state portion of it, and the state portion we've already got that lease for that portion, so they would know that route right now because we already have the lease.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Passman.
What are the comparable provisions under the federal law with respect to, in other words, if someone were to say, you know, you got a federal stream you're crossing and we want to protect that federal stream, what limitations, time limitations might there be? In other words, how are we in comparison to the federal system?
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, that's an excellent question. I'd like to refer to Tina online, Tina Grovier.
Ms. Grovier, did you hear the question?
I believe I did, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pascal, and through the chair, this provision, Section 5, is modeled on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act, which was a special piece of legislation that regards to TAPs. I do not know whether, it is my understanding that there would not be any comparable federal statute that would apply to federal land at this time.
But if I could just follow up in answer to Senator Passman's question, the feds treat challenges to their rights of way the same way that this statute does for TAPs?
No.
Okay, I didn't understand.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can clarify. I think the answer is that while the feds have treated challenges to its rights of ways in this manner in the past, for example, under TAPA, which is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act, I do not believe that there is necessarily one that would apply to this pipeline. And that's what I understood Senator Passman's comment to be going to, is along this same pipeline.
Senator Passman.
What I'm trying to find out is what is the current federal law that, as I understand, there may be 200 or more miles that are federal right-of-way law will apply to. And someone may have a legal right to challenge under the federal law that issuance of a right-of-way because of a stream crossing or whatever it might be. What is their system currently?
Right. Senator Paxton, to the chair, I will find out for you.
Thank you for the clarification. It's a fair question. The state's going to treat its right-of-way sort of in one legal method. What legal method will the feds use for their right-of-way? Senator Coghill.
Just one short question. I thought I saw and noticed that the Corps of Engineers with BLM is already doing some public meetings. Do they explain that part to the public as they go forward, or are they only doing the state right-of-way issues?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the Corps of Engineers is only doing the federal portion of the right-of-way. That's the DEIS process we're going through right now, the draft environmental impact statement. And they don't have anything to do with it all with the state right-of-way. They're focused only on the federal lands, and that's the process we're in the middle of right now. And we have held public meetings all the way down our alignment from Barrow, New Ixit, all the way down to Anchorage and Wasilla. I mean, we've had meetings all up and down the right-of-way.
Just ask one.
Senator Pastor.
In other words, we've had in Interior Alaska this last summer, it was a big dust-up over a guy that was in a federal area that was on a boat, And the question is are the waterways even on Alaska land part of a federal waters system? And so is the federal system going to apply to even portions of the state right-of-way system? So no matter what we try to put into place for the state portion, if it's waterways is part of the federal waterways process of appeal or challenge or whatever it might be.
Through the chair to Senator Pascavan. So under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act uses the phrase waters of the United States, a phrase which is not defined anywhere in statute, and a phrase which is hotly disputed as to the meaning even today. The EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers have promulgated regulations that set out what they believe a waterway to waters of the United States to mean. Those regulations were reversed in large part by a case in the 90s whose name is escaping me right now. I don't believe a court has reviewed and upheld any particular definition of the waters of the United States, so there is some ambiguity. It's clear that it includes navigable waters. It's clear that it includes adjacent wetlands. Something in the interior of Alaska, accepting that it's adjacent to a river that is a navigable waterway, probably is not the waters of the United States.
Senator Pascan.
I would like to receive a little something in writing that kind of goes through that so that I can wrap my head around it, so that I think we're still trying to figure out what the federal system is, where the federal law may apply and may not apply.
Through the chair to Senator Pascavan, we can work on trying to bring as much clarity as it is possible to bring without further action by the Supreme Court.
Understood. Thank you.
Very good. And just to round out, I think we were just discussing, for the public who might be listening, on page 7, we were discussing subsection D, lines 9 to 13. Is that is this provision necessary because of our taking primacy on permits? I'm getting a head nod.
If I could, I'd like to defer to Ruth Heese, who is responsible for this provision.
Very good. We'll get a short primer on this, and then we'll be done. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Ruth Hamilton has the Department of Law on behalf of Department of Environmental Conservation. And we had a couple of discussions with the sponsor regarding some language in Section 6,
mm-hmm.
looking specifically at Subsection D. And
well, hold on, just for a point of order. Section 6 begins on line 14 of page 7. I'm looking at the preceding lines 9 to 13.
Oh, I don't have the blank choice. Thank you. All right, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And the programs that are covered under this are the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Program, which is under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act, as well as Title I and Title V air emission programs that DEC administers, and they are comparable to Title I and Title V of the Federal Clean Air Act. And so we have been approved to administer those three programs. And so there is some concern about the language in Subsection D, and we have suggested to the sponsor that we just add some language for clarity. So if I may.
Please.
An appeal of a permitting decision inserting or authorization, because some of the actions that the commissioner may take or the divisions would be authorizations versus permits. So we feel that clarity is needed. And then continue with the existing language by the Department of Environmental Conservation under AS4603 or AS4614 that is made under insert a program approved or delegated. And that's important because some of the programs may be delegated or approved. There's nomenclature differences. And so this just helps bring clarity so that people know that these programs are the ones we're talking about. And then we would strike suggest, right? The Department of Environmental Conservation, because it's redundant to what we've already said.
Okay.
Refer to them once, and then continue with the language that's existing by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and then continue on with those to the remainder of the section. So it's a very simple clarification.
To accompany, but I mean, just for broad general purposes, what we're saying is that appeals to this aspect of our handling of Clean Water Act permits does not fall under the restrictive outlines that we've put into law in subsection C.
Chairman, that's correct, and that's also true for the air.
Water and air, okay. So what we're really restricting is land, just for the...
Right, okay.
Mr. Wright, you have something you want to add? No, very good. Yeah, please.
Tom Wright again for the record. Again, you know, we put the I can't think of the proper term, but took DEC out of this action because, again, there was a question of whether or not the EPA then would come in or take away the state's control over clean water or clean air, excuse me. And also the state has the ability to administer the Clean Water
Act,
the Clean Water Act. You know, under the language that she prescribed. And in our other legislation, we did take the recommendations, and it wasn't included in the CS. We tried to match up the CS here with what was included in the other bill. This was done after the fact, but we do have that language in another bill, which, you know, we would be more than happy to rectify if that's the committee's desire.
That we were going to get to that at some point, but I'm glad you brought it up. We are running out of time. Closing, anybody want to make some closing remarks? Mr. Dugler? No, everybody happy? Okay, we put in a good work session on this bill. Thanks for your attention, and thank you for all being here today. I really appreciate that. With that, we're adjourned.